BCFM, community radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello, and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from the BCFM studios this week at the Beacon Centre, very fancy in Bristol, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and those all over the world, including South America, our producer assures me, and hello to Anne Campbell in Australia. You'll hear the second part of her interview about the Aborigines this week. We have two studio guests this week, Drew Marland, and she's here to talk about the book Coming Drusilla. Sons of Sunday will be playing some of their music. We have features from Tony and Anthea, our dialect reporters. Malcolm Grieve reads another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, set in Oxfordshire between 1920 and 1930. And Jeff Sparks is back to bring us the very latest in what's on going on in Bristol. I'm John Peters Coleman, presenter of this week's show. Welcome now to Drusilla. Hello. Before we begin the interview, we're going to listen to a clip that was recorded at the tobacco factory at the launch of the book Becoming Drusilla. This interview is with Tony from Southville, who works for Bristol Gay and Bisexual Forum, and it was broadcast on Dialect a few weeks ago, but this is the first part of the original interview.
My name is Tony. We're at the tobacco factory for the launch of the book.
What's the name of the book?
The name is called Becoming Drusilla by Richard Beard, which is about the transition of Drusilla from Andrew to Drusilla. I'd expected it to be very much about Richard's prejudice. I expected it to be about his prejudice, his resistance to the transition Andrew made into Drusilla, but it wasn't. It was about him examining his own prejudice about gender identity, trying to get his head round how Andrew was morphing into Drusilla and almost playing the deus ex machina, looking at the way that Drusilla was learning to be the person she was inside.
But it's not a new thing, is it?
It isn't. I think there has always been conflict within human beings about what their true identity is. The world tries to impose on us an external identity, and yet so many people, you can see it in the way they move, in the way they talk, in their sensibilities, that they may not be entirely comfortable within the gender that their physical body has assigned them. And with Drusilla, I find it entirely comfortable. It is a different and a new take to have another voice other than the protagonist to commentate on how that transition, how a friend views that transition, how they see that morphing, the way that we might observe a caterpillar turning into a butterfly, but from the outside. And yet, at the same time, knowing that person very intimately and seeing how all the traits that they had once identified as male are nothing more than perhaps a female that likes boys' things.
But do you think it's more the person who has the problem rather than the public? I mean, A lot of people here don't worry, do they, whether if a man turns into a woman and, as I say, chooses to be a woman, well, I think people are quite broad-minded about that now, aren't they?
I think some people are, but I think if we are honest, a lot of people have problems, and each and one, every one of us, in the privacy of our own heads, have to question, do I have a problem with that? Because we all like to believe ourselves to be liberal and open-minded, but actually a lot of us are really quite oldie-worldy and all fogey. I think, in fact, this liberalism we anoint ourselves with is just a mask. I think a lot of us are prejudiced, and I think society is trying to wear a whole lot of masks on its sexual and gender fascism. There is an identity which you're supposed to conform with, and if you do not, you are a novelty, an amusement, but not somebody I would really like my children to hang out with, not really somebody I would like to invite to dinner.
So why do you say that?
because I come across that all the time. And I had to work hard on my notion of, well, you know, how can these people be women? They were born men. They didn't experience their childhood as women. They didn't experience childbirth. How can they possibly know what it's like to be a woman? But then how do I know what it's like to be a woman? I only know my own feelings. I don't know how other women feel. And perhaps this is more about how each and every one of us knows ourselves to be, rather than as other people see us. And that's what Richard was telling us in this book.
Well, now that we've listened to that, I'm here in the studio with Drusilla right now. Hello.
Hello.
When you discovered that Richard was going to, your friend Richard was going to be writing a book, well, how did you discover that? And what were your first feelings when he sort of said that he was going to write a book?
I was very interested because my experiences with my co-workers prior to the writing of the book had demonstrated to me, I think, that people need to be educated in as nice a way as possible.
Yeah.
Because there's so much misinformation and misunderstanding about transsexual people.
Mm. How did he come across when he said he was writing a book? I imagine if I was going to be writing a book about somebody I knew, I'd be a little bit nervous about sort of telling them. How did he come across?
Well, fine. You see, Richard and I have known each other for a very long time, and we've gone off and done all sorts of very adventurous things together. In my pre-transition days, and you know, when you do things like canoeing across the Bristol Channel together, you end up trusting that person very strongly.
Okay.
I knew that I could absolutely rely upon him, and I think he could rely upon me. So it was very much a team effort, the book.
Okay. I suppose I should sort of explain a little bit. I mean, you took P&O Ferries to court to try out to a tribunal.
Yes, that's right.
Because of the way that your fellow employees behaved towards you.
Yes.
I read about one particular incident where a female nudes calendar was put up, and the typical kind of remark was, you know, look at this as a training manual.
Yes.
How do you feel when sort of people say these things towards you?
I felt completely outraged, but also really helpless, because this attitude ran all the way through the culture out in the ship, at least in the engine room where I was working. Because these people had no idea of, you know, what constituted appropriate behaviour.
Right.
I think that modern people understand that they're not allowed to be racist, you know, openly racist or sexist, but they think that a transsexual person comes along and they're some fabulous creature that that is outside the norm. They can do whatever they like, and it exposed me to some very horrible behaviour.
Right. What were your first when a book from an old friend of yours came out about it? How did you? What was your first reaction to it when you sort of, you know, you saw this? Did you write it in sort of with you? Did he sort of consult you a lot, or did you sort of just receive a finished product?
Oh no, it was very collaborative. Richard spent a long time doing, you know, a thorough amount of background reading. He knows his, you know, he's done more reading on the context than I have. I just lived the life, you know.
Right.
And having, you know, got all our background work done, we formed the book around a fortnight's walk through Wales.
Right.
So it's a mixture of biography and this extended conversation that we have while we're getting drenched in the Welsh mountains. And
right.
That sort of thing. We've got several journeys going on in the book, you see. There's Richard's description of my journey through transition and through life, his description of his own evolving understanding, and our mutual journey through Wales.
Okay.
Quite clever, really.
How long ago did you first begin to think that you would want to become a transsexual? Because I suppose a lot of people think you go into the operation and it's your snip snip, and then it's sort of fairly sudden, whereas you described it more as a very slow metamorphosis.
Yes. If I may correct you, as mildly as possible, I didn't wish to become a transsexual.
Phrased in the wrong way.
I know. It's all terminology. We're all muddling our way through, and hopefully meaning well. But my feelings about my my personal identity had never particularly changed, but I was aware, I think, that something was wrong when puberty came in, and I felt really miserable about it. And I was able to identify that sense of wrongness with my personal identity as female.
Yeah.
It just took a very long... I thought at the time, this was back in the, you know, the early 70s, there was nowhere really to look for information about it, and I just felt very isolated and alone. It's only quite recently that I've been able to sort of identify or realise that I'm... that not everybody feels that sort of way, and that I could do something about it and should do something about it.
Yeah.
That was when I took steps to transition.
I'm imagining with the advent of the internet, there is a forum for you to get in touch with a lot wider variety of people who are in the same situation or have been in the same situation. How many links do you have with people who sort of wish to sort of change their...
Most of my communication has been through the internet. It's been a very empowering tool, and a lot of people are finding that way. A lot of people in all sorts of minorities, I think, are finding a voice and finding a community.
I found it very interesting that you said that, you know, we do have very sort of, we understand the politically correct rules about how to behave around issues of like race and ageism and such like that. What do you think can be done to further people's understanding of issues such as yours? Because like obviously I sort of said, you know, when did you discover you wanted to become transsexual?
Yes.
It's like a wrong phraseology, but what do you think can be sort of done to... how do we go about...
I think perhaps desensationalising us. I think the media has got a lot to be blamed for in its portrayal of transsexual people. The media stereotype that comes to mind is Little Britain, of course, and that is very pervasive, that sort of portrayal. But I also found that when the press were dealing with my tribunal, that they were moulding the case to fit this standard, as it were, tranny narrative.
Right.
And it was very corrosive. It was rather odd reading something about, as it were, a stranger, because they weren't particularly interested in the facts. Education, that's what we did this book for. You know, people don't like being educated per se, which is why I think we made a jolly good book, which is fun to read.
Okay. Do you think perhaps that issues such as that should be raised perhaps in sort of sex education earlier in people's lives, like when they're younger, as they get older, you know, it won't be such a sensational thing, is it?
Yes, I think that teaching about diversity in schools is very helpful.
Certainly, it was never at all raised, you know, when I went through my sex education. I mean,
we didn't have sex education at my school. Certainly.
How can we get hold of this book?
It's available in all good bookshops and at Amazon.
At Amazon, okay. And it's by Richard Beard, and it's called Becoming Drusilla.
And it's published by Vintage Paperback.
Vintage Paperback.
Yes.
Okay, well, thank you. I would like to have gone on, but we sort of ran out of time, unfortunately. But thank you very much for coming in today, and I hope that, as you say, it becomes desensationalised, as you say.
Yes.
Because I have worked in environments myself where there have been people there, and it is, like you're saying, nobody knows how to react to that. So they go, oh, yeah, that's... And it is sort of sensational. So.
Yes. I think the worst response you can get is where someone's afraid to say anything in case they offend. I mean, you know when someone wants to offend. There's the difference.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Some music now for popular Bristol singer and guitarist Katie Brooks.
God said he was a true speaker. cause I've got a lot of heart for you. For you, there ain't no bones I need to hide. Upon my mouth, no eyes upon the time. 'Cause I don't wanna be alone without you by my side. 'Cause I am a true speaker, and I've got a lot of time for you. Worth its weight in gold, and the eyes I have for you, my dear, can't be bought nor sold. So I won't be bargaining my love away. But we can be friends, and they tell me I am foolish for being awake to my dreams. Those are the words of men who lack freedom, of men who lack soul. But I am a true speaker, and I've got a lot of soul for you. Just to feel your arms in mine is worth its weight in gold, and the eyes I have for you, my dear, can't be bought nor sold. So I won't be bargaining my love away.
Our first feature from Tony Gosling this week, questions over the alleged suicide of government scientist David Kelly refused to go away. The case for the invasion of Iraq was the consequence, and the failure of the coroner to conduct a proper inquest. That was just one of the anomalies along the way. One West Country retired surgeon spoke out about the circumstances surrounding David Kelly's death at the Alternative View Conference. That was last weekend at Heathrow Airport.
Right, I'm David Halpin, a retired orthopaedic and trauma surgeon. You speak of David Kelly. I was interested in with the investigation of his unnatural death from about from December the 16th, 2003. I wrote a little letter to the Morning Star, knowing I support the Morning Star anyway, but I knew no other paper would publish the letter. And in this short letter, I said that I didn't wish to cause any discomfort to the grieving family, but I did want to express my doubt that this man could have died from hemorrhage caused by the cutting of his wrist, however deep. I went on to say that I found it difficult to understand how a man with his scientific knowledge would have chosen such a most uncertain way to end his life. That is, with coproximal tablets, which were allegedly from his wife, who had rheumatoid arthritis or something similar, and a pruning knife. And that letter led me into a little group of people, one, a lady who wasn't medically qualified, called Rowena Thursby, and a fellow called Stephen Frost, who was an interventional radiologist, and an increasing group of other doctors came in. And they all had appropriate specialties in considering how this man could have died in this way, whether the investigation was sufficient, and if it wasn't sufficient, what should we do about it? The key fellow was Searle Sennett. This gives you some idea of the reach. He was a retired anaesthetist from Johannesburg, British train, like Barts, I think, and he felt very strongly that Kelly had not, well, he thought it was highly unlikely he'd taken his life. And being as anaesthetist, he was more used to considering body chemistry. And he was also a very good researcher. We questioned each other. It was a very scientific group. It wasn't, as they would paint us, a conspiracy theorist group. And Searle was very good in his research. Remember, he looked at 40 papers to investigate the question of what happens to morphine or morphine analogues, morphine-like drugs, when you sample the tissues or the vessels after death. And, you know, it came up with a remarkable, I can't remember the figures now exactly, but, you know, morphine will increase by something like tenfold within 24 hours of death. So that, things like that, and the more central you're sampling, say, from the vena cava, from the main vessel in the abdomen, could also be elevated artificially because of proximity, closeness to the gut, where the drug was lying, if it had been taken in by the gut.
So why was that significant, that information?
About the morphine, well, the thing is that dextropropoxifene is the drug which is in coproximol, and it's a morphine-like drug. And he was, as it happened, Dr. Allen, who was the forensic pathologist, forensic chemist, I can't remember the exact title, the levels of these two agents, the paracetamol doesn't kill you anyway, initially. It kills you about 5 days later with liver failure. So forget the paracetamol, but the dextropropoxifene was something like a third of the normal of the level which he would normally associate with death. Now, the thing is that he, of course, is mostly seeing, he's not seeing live people surviving in the hospitals, he's seeing corpses. So even that has to be balanced. You know, don't go cantering off into that response. It might not be that significant, and some people have put a lot of weight on that, but that's what he found. He said it was about a third of the level he's associated with death. There's a little question mark, or a big question mark, attaching to that, and that is that the dextropropoxifene, this morphine analogue, can cause arrhythmia, and people can die of that. And they made a great play of this, some of the people who were trying to...
That's an irregular heartbeat, is it?
Yes, irregular heartbeat. The people who said that, yes, I should have said that, the people who were saying that, Professor Milroy and Forrest, they were trying to undermine our case. Our case being that we wanted a proper inquest for this, our most senior, most experienced germ warfare and chemical warfare expert. He had full clearance by the CIA. He was being considered for I don't know much about honours and have no little respect for them, but he was being considered, I think, for a KCFMG, something like that. He already had two. He had his MD, and he also had some honour from the state, which I have just forgotten for the moment. But this was a very widely respected man who'd been to Iraq 37 times. He debriefed the Russians after Perestroika with their very, so we're told, very extensive germ warfare, chemical warfare projects. And he was known in many places, I think.
So what about the inquest? Because that was rather abruptly ended. It took a lot less time than an inquest would normally take.
Well, the inquest was opened by a man called Nicholas Gardner. And I can't remember, the date of that.
He's the Oxfordshire coroner, I think.
Yes, and then it was subsumed. Then it was felt, I'm not sure it was subsumed into the Hutton Inquiry, you know, in other words, taken within it. I don't think it was.
No, it was adjourned, I think, when they announced...
He adjourned the inquest after, I think, two hearings, very brief. I'm not sure even they were public. I'm not sure they were publicised. Then the Hutton Inquiry came out on March the 16th, I think it was. Nicholas Gardner opened inquest and shut it after 16 minutes. And I was being interviewed, actually, at the time. I could tell you a story about that, which is of some interest. The Sky people. He did not... He couldn't close it. There wasn't a hearing. So he couldn't say, right, we're finished. It was adjourned. And that was confirmed by Harriet Harman in 2005. But they've changed their tack on that. And I don't, there's something about it was they agreed to close it during the Hutton inquiry or something. There's a certain amount of shuffling going on. But I can always remember speaking about, I'm not sure whether it was during, when we were expecting to hear, no, it was a BBC interview, but some other thing when the sky came down. And they interviewed me about Dr. Kelly's death and the inquest that we wanted. And I gave what I thought was a very good interview to a chap I knew from the Dove and Dolphin Voyage who interviewed me then. He was all smart, shoes polished, most unusual. And they had this for about 40 minutes, in fact, and I spoke with some vigour. And do you know, as I was being filmed, the cameraman became paler and paler. They shot off at the end of it, back to Bristol, where the Sky office is, in fact, on some industrial estate, and not 1 second was shown, as far as I know. And I can never, I don't know what was going on or whatever. All I'm doing is saying what I feel as a doctor and citizen. And I'm not going to have untruth rule this land.
Dartmoor retired orthopaedic surgeon David Halpin there, talking about the death of government scientist David Kelly, and more on that next week. Time now for some music from Bristol's popular band Sons of Sunday. Okay, what was the name of that tune?
That last one was called Genie. Which is, we were trying to, because we were thinking of what to say our songs are about earlier. Yeah, this is about me being single and, stroppy about it and wondering if I'll ever meet the right one. Which I did.
You will? Yeah. Oh, you did?
I did.
Yeah. Oh, it has a happy ending.
Yeah.
Oh, nice one. Man. Crack on.
Yeah, cool. Sometimes I sit and wonder if I already know you, and if I do, I wonder what I've said. Maybe I never showed you all the things I should have shown you, and that's why you're lying in someone else's bed. I wonder if wherever you are, you're thinking the same thing. When you close your eyes, is it me you see? Maybe I don't know you, but you already know me, and it's happening oblivious to me. Sometimes I find it hard to comprehend. Sometimes I find it hard to understand. But then again, maybe I should grow some balls and be a man. To comprehend, sometimes I find it hard to understand. But then again, maybe I should grow some balls and be a man.
Kind of a bit at the end where you kind of think you should kind of give a little round of applause because there's only two of us, it would sound rather pathetic.
Much better to compare it to Jim David, so
yeah.
That's all the compliment
makes you look good. Yeah. Well, I think we've got like a rounded through the various songs, we've got a rounded kind of picture of your personality, Andy. Where can people find out more about where are you being? Where are you playing?
We've got a gig coming up on the 26th. At the Grant Bradley Gallery in Bedminster.
Grant Bradley Gallery in Bedminster.
Called Homegrown. Which is about promoting local talent from Bedminster. And we're on MySpace on the Sons of Sunday and on Facebook as well on Sons of Sunday.
Cool. So out there in this land, you have no excuse. You haven't done. Brilliant. Thank you very much. And I'm sadly, now it's time to. That's all we've got time for.
Okay.
Brilliant.
Thank you very much. Cheers.
It's time now for another instalment of The Innkeeper's Diary, read by Malcolm Greaves. A story set in Oxfordshire, in case you haven't been listening, between 1920 and 1930. If you remember from last week, if you were, in 1922, out of the need to earn a living, Mr. John Fothergill moved with his family to Tame in Oxfordshire to run the Spread Eagle Inn. The people and customs he came across were not quite what he was expecting or used to. He wrote about his experiences in a diary. The intro music, a tune called Old Molly Oxford, was performed by musicians in the famous Royal Navy Volunteer Pub, that's in King Street in Bristol, very good pub, and if you would like to play with them, meet every Tuesday for an impromptu music session, and you can just turn up and join in.
An Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill. Face Money. Last Sunday we had 39 folks to tea, and I noticed they were almost all ill-shaped, ugly, or ill-dressed. I came into the office and complained at having to work for such people at 1 shilling and 6 pence a head. Charles Nielsen said, "That's easy. Put up a notice. Buy our masks at 1 shilling each or pay 6 pence extra." So I went in and told Phyllis to charge 6 pence face money each for the worst cases.
Thus, for the first time in history, seven people, without knowing it, have left an inn having paid sixpence each for not being beautiful. Surely this was a more praiseworthy action than the usual one of charging people extra because they are beautiful or well-bred or dressed. An old gentleman arrived for the night, aged 73, after a 90-mile ride on a pushbike from Southampton. Though otherwise perfectly sane and pleasant, he said he objected wherever he went to paying sixpence for a cold bath. So I had to extemporise a defence for the irritating charge. Each room has to pay its share of rent and roof and upkeep, besides the cost of the plant, water, towel and soap, and the keeping of others out. Otherwise the room might be used as a bedroom, for which presumably he didn't mind paying. Recently, however, we've raised the price of the room to make the bath free. On the Dutch principle of a sixpenny thing post-free for eightpence. 1925. The first 4 days holiday. We are just finishing 4 days holiday. After 3 years daily work from 7 a.m. to often any hour after midnight. Naturally, our only thought was food. The first meal was luncheon at one of the big, long-established hotels where we stayed the night. The people were inferior, and the hors d'oeuvre good, but the rest of the meal I couldn't eat for its falseness and tastelessness. Price, 6 shillings. Next day we lunched very well at a little restaurant. But how he put it across us, that patron, who, when he comes here on Sundays, has always 2 vast helpings of our wonderful meat. Then miles away to an equally noted hotel in the country. Here, I costed the 7 shilling and 6pence dinner, scrap by scrap, and it totaled 1 shilling and 4pence a head. The last of the sharabangs. The honorary secretary of a suburban motor club that was to have tea here, 80 of them, came in advance with a party to luncheon. After swinging the lead a bit, he sent for me to tell me that there were vegetables for not more than 3 out of the 5 of his party. I said, "You've come very late, and you've had a delicious salad, and everything has been to my utmost satisfaction." This scotched him pro tem, but he rose again afterwards to demand a reduction for shortage of vegetables. With ill breeds like this about, it was consoling to be told by the Fagans at the next table that 15 years ago they came together and are happier today than ever, and are keeping their fate here for 2 days. At tea time, to our surprise, only a handful of the 80 club members turned up, and I learnt that their revengeful secretary had warned them off, so they missed a very good tea. And later, the RAC ruled that the secretary should pay up for the full 80. But this was a pleasant experience compared with 60 sharabang men we had for dinner from the East End. I saw their horrid sharabangs coming along the clean and empty Sunday street swoop down upon us and pull up. The 60-strong, great, burly, black, broadcloth-suited brutes with buttonholes all the same coloured target leapt out and, already semi-tight, swung round the back of the sharabang and began to pull cases of beer out of the boot. With quick courage, I had the beer put back. They swarmed over the yard and into the big room where they all ate, inter alia, 1¼ pounds of meat per head and got quite drunk. Later Kate came to tell me they were all out in the yard again, cursing and yelling out for me, and at the same time a deputation of 3 came in to tell me that I had grossly underfed them, and that they wouldn't undertake to get the men out of the place unless I knocked 6pence off a head. I gave way meekly, and out they went. How much better to have called in the police and got their money. Our last sharabang party. Since becoming butler, I think I've discovered why wine has to go round with the sun. In Italy, if you pour wine into the glass of the man on your right, with the back of your hand downwards, it is an outrage. I suppose because it is casual, because to do it otherwise would be arduous. Well, if you make a universal rule that wine should go round towards the left or with the sun, to avoid the word sinister, no one can offend. The butler therefore needn't observe the rule, though he does. I offered 4 shy undergraduates at luncheon, plum pudding or chapel harlot. I told this, my spoonerism, to a lady who asked me if our tame tart was a variant of the same delicacy. To 2 perfectly decent people, but of the self-centred order, I asked as they arrived for the night, "And where are you going to?" "To Shropshire. We only stopped the night here because we thought it was going to thunder." "What can you do with such tactlessness?" And they made it worse later by saying they'd been here before. so presumably only a thunderstorm would bring them in again. Next day, the woman of another couple, less decent and very pretentious, standing before the beautiful Sheraton four-poster given to me by Michael Salaman, said to Katie Lomas, "What a funny old bed! Is it clean?" Katie, aghast, told her all the beds were clean. Then the woman proceeded to turn it back and over. Soon afterwards, I caught them sitting in the garden. "You've offended me and the whole staff by your examining that bed." "But I always do it." "Yes, but when I received you, you should have known at once that you were in a most distinguished inn kept by a most distinguished gentleman. Have you ever tried raw asparagus? Try it." And I pushed them into her hand and went away feeling rather staggered by my awful self. Albeit, I felt that if only for the sake of the decent people who ultimately are to be supreme, I must continue to battle quietly with the second-rate and the proud. A lady wrote asking for rooms for a week, for the Colonel and herself, her son and daughter, maid, chauffeur and car, ending with, "The beds must be comfortable and well-aired." "Now you've dropped a brick," I thought. So I replied, giving full details as to how I could accommodate her, but added, "Merely as a P.S. We do not air the beds." And I never heard any more. The reason why you get such a poor reception at the average English inn is generally because the proprietor knows that he cannot, or will not, do you well, and being at the bottom a Christian, he hates the sight of you as a living sacrifice. I myself find it difficult at all times to receive folks with perfect confidence and send them away with a clean heart.
Thank you very much to Malcolm Greaves as ever for his excellent reading, and you can hear another instalment next week. Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with Anne Campbell from Australia, who was visiting Bristol a few weeks ago. It's about the Aborigines.
I'm Anne Campbell, and I come from Australia. I actually grew up on the edge of the Nullarbor Plain, on the edge of the desert, which is midway between Western Australia and South Australia.
What's the Australian government doing about the Aborigines?
The present government has been doing a lot because it's the first government that's ever said, "I'm sorry," to the Aborigines. In the past, we've ignored them. We've given them a lot of government handouts in terms of money and hope that that will be rectify the situation. It doesn't, because their culture has been destroyed. They haven't had the opportunities in education that white people have, and nor do they value it as much as white people, I might add. So it's a bit of wrong on both sides, and so they have. It's been a very difficult transition to come into our world. It hasn't worked by governments so far.
How many Aborigines are there?
Well, the true Aboriginal population is very, very small, but the Aborigines believe, and even if they have a tenth of a percent of blood in Aboriginal blood, they are Aboriginals.
And how many half-castes are there many?
The majority of the Aborigines aren't pure Aboriginals, very few of them.
So does that take them away from their roots slightly?
No, it doesn't.
Is there any hope in the future for the Aborigines?
I think
not?
It's going to be a long, long road, and I think that we have to encourage the elders to start taking responsibility. A lot of this starts, a lot of the problems start from their lack of self-worth. They haven't got their culture. They haven't got any meaning to their lives.
And that's because they've been taken, subjugated?
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. So it's going to be a long, long process. And it's not... the saying sorry was the start of it, but it's by no means the end. And the end will come many, 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 many years away. But I hope they have started in the right direction, and they're really sincere with helping them. But there are a lot of good things that are starting to happen. Their standard of living is starting to increase. The death rate is still appalling for infants in the Western world.
Babies
and young children.
Why?
Malnutrition, probably, yes. And that's as much a problem because of the parents' lack of education as to what to really do with the children. And of course, being in remote places, they haven't got the same facilities. They're not able to get as instant medical attention as as people in towns can get.
So it's distance and history.
History, not knowing what to do both for them and for the policy makers, I think. There's no real policy, long-term policy, as to how to deal with the problem.
So what's the average Australian attitude to Aborigines? Turn back and not think about them, hope the problem goes away?
Hope the problem goes away and just don't think about them. And of course you can get away with that in many parts of Australia because they're not visible. It's only when you go to, say, for instance, I was absolutely shocked of what I saw in a place called Port Augusta many years ago, because there were very high concentrated Aboriginals, and yet there wasn't one black person who was employed in the shops or anywhere that I could see. So they're not, haven't had the same opportunities, nor are people prepared to give them the same.
So that was deliberate?
Probably deliberate. And I'm actually going back there in November, and I'm really looking forward to seeing whether there is any real change, but I suspect there hasn't been much. The people that are in the cities who don't see them don't want to think about them, and the people who do see them don't want to see them.
So it's a never-ending...
It's a never-ending battle for survival for them. And I think because they've been so subjugated for so many generations, they've just given up themselves, and it's difficult to work out how to get them out of this sorry mess. And it is a sorry mess
unless everyone cleared off. And
there are attempts. We have been doing that, but you know, we've got this Uluru, which used to be called
which is an Aboriginal name,
Big Red Rock in the centre.
Oh, Ayers Rock.
Ayers Rock, sorry. Yes, now they actually have that back, and they're in control of that.
That's symbolic though, isn't it?
It is symbolic, it is, but it is a start. It's a start. And there are other settlements where they have been encouraged, and sometimes they're successful and sometimes they aren't. But much depends on the seniors or the elders, because that's how their society is run.
But when the elders die and new elders take over, do they have the same attitude as the previous elders?
One would hope that they learn from the elders and actually do better for the next ones, but I'm not in a position to tell that. I know in Northern Territory they're trying to do a lot of things to help the elders, and in fact some of the judges are going back to the old tribal ways of dealing with offences, and some of them are quite controversial. There's one judge that allowed an Aboriginal to be speared, because that was their method of dealing with a transgression, just in the leg or something. And there was a lot of controversy over that. But our method of dealing with the Aboriginals, locking them up and putting them in prison, isn't working. So he thought, well, let the elders decide what the fate of the wrongdoers.
And what was the outcome?
Well, the outcome was a lot of publicity in the press, and then it all died down, and I have no idea what the outcome was. But I think to a degree, by giving back the power to the elders, if they choose to do the traditional way of keeping law and order, and it works, without having murder and total mayhem, it may not be a bad thing. If you look at the history of the Aborigines, they weren't one tribe. There were hundreds and hundreds of tribes, all different, speaking different languages. So they're not really one ethnic group, a very broad spectrum of people that happen to come under the one term Aboriginal.
Is that because of the size of the country?
The size of the country, and because it's so dry that they had little pockets of Aboriginals, and maybe there was one band of Aboriginals that came from perhaps New Guinea or somewhere. And then they dispersed, and gradually over time their language and their culture, and indeed their looks, got different, because the Aborigines, if you look in the rabbit-proof fence, the tracker is a very black man. Now as you go further south, they are more light in colour, and yet they can still be 100% Aboriginal. So even their colour is different, and their facial features, their flatness of their nose is different. So they're not one group of people.
But the Aborigines, they have a very interesting link with nature, don't they?
They do. And that's where they...
Medicines, yes, and...
Yes.
almost like storytelling.
Yes, yes.
So could that not be taught more in schools?
Well, it should be taught. I don't know whether it's taught in their schools, and it should be taught in our schools, and I think some of it is, because I can remember telling stories to... I was a teacher at one stage, an English teacher, and I told stories to the young school children that I was teaching. I had an excellent book that was given to me, and it was all about the Aboriginal dream time, and the explanation for how things happen, rainbows and various... animals, how they got their characteristics, and that was their method of trying to work out why things happened. They made up these stories, and it continued by mouth from generation to generation.
So that's worth preserving, isn't it?
It is worth preserving, yes. And a lot of good is being done, because there are a lot of people that are going and they're writing down these stories now. And they're actually even encouraging different languages, because, as I say, it wasn't one group. There are many, many, many languages. Thanks to the computer era, there have been people that have been going there and listening to the sounds, and the computer then can formulate it into words that it can be written down. So that's only the way that it's becoming a written language now. There was never, ever a written language per se, but this is how we are writing it. It's sheer interpretation that the computer does of what comes out of somebody's mouth. The Aborigines are going to be there forever, and we, the government and the people, have to find a solution working with them so that they can get dignity, they can get education, they can get equal opportunities.
And still keep their identity.
And still keep their identity. It's so important that they have their identity, that it's recognised. I think one day, if Australia ever decides to become a republic, that part of their flag should be integrated into our flag. And their flag is a symbol. It's red, black and yellow, meaning the earth, the sun and the sky. And that should be part of the flag, because they are part of our culture, or we should be part of their culture, because we were the invaders. But that remains to be seen, and I hope for the future that that's what they get.
That was Anthony Page talking to Anne Cabral about the Aborigines. Jeff Sparks is here to bring us What's On in Bristol.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio, starting with Friday, June the 12th, and the Led Zeppelin tribute group Whole Lotta Lead will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Also on 12th of June, Chris Scott's Blues Devil will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is free. Moving on to Song of the Week, and I feature Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble. This is from his debut album, Texas Flood, which was released in 1983, and this is the track Pride and Joy.
Little boy. coming to the land of time. I'm shooting my sweet little thing. She's my pride and joy. She's my sweet little baby. I'm a little lover boy. Yeah, I love my baby, my heart and soul. Love like eyes I won't never grow. She's my sweet little thing. She's my pride and joy. She's my sweet little baby. I'm a little lover boy.
That was Stevie Ray Vaughan and Double Trouble with the track Pride and Joy from the album Texas Flood. For more information on Stevie Ray Vaughan, you can check out www.stevieray.com. Moving on to Saturday 13th of June, and Caustic Yoda will be performing at the Fire Engine, which is at 188 Church Road in Redfield, Bristol. Now this group features ex-members of Osmium who split up a few years ago. The gig starts at 8:30 p.m. and entry is free. Also on 13th of June, Kick the Cat will be performing at the Prom Bar in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. On to Sunday 14th of June, Eddie Martin's Blues Band will be performing at the Old Duke in Bristol. The gig starts around 9 p.m. and entry is free. Finally on Monday 15th of June, Papa Roach, Buck Cherry and In This Moment will all be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £17 in advance. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much to Jeff. Obviously for health and safety reasons we must stress that kicking old cats is immoral and bad and can only be enjoyed purely for entertainment reasons. Coming up on the 25th of June, this is quite a way in advance, a couple of weeks, but Reckless Eric of late 70s fame is playing at the Fleece and Firkin. It's great to see a really good artist, you know, instead of just a sort of roster of tribute bands and stuff, which they usually have on. He's great. Reconnais Cherie was the hit that you might recognise, and if you don't know who Rex Eric is, go and check him out and come down. It's only £5 as well. What a bargain. That's all from Dialect Radio this week. In the studio were Drusilla Marland talking about the book Becoming Drusilla by Richard Beard. That is available in, as always, all good bookshops. Only bad ones will not stock it, and on Amazon.com. We heard the Sons of Sunday, a local band who joined us in the studio today. They were so committed they even hired a car to get to the studio in Lawrence Hill. How committed. You can find them on Facebook and on MySpace. You can also find Katie Brooks. She's on MySpace as well. We played her earlier. That's K-A-T-E-Y Brooks. Malcolm Grieve read another chapter of The Innkeeper's Diary by John Fothergill, and the features were by Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Jeff Marks brought us What's On in Bristol, and the studio engineer was Alistair Grant. What a patient man he is. The producer was Anthony Page, and I am John Peters Collin. Take care of yourselves until next week. Adieu.